begin. Okay, once again, as we have the previous 2 years now, Baruch Hashem, this is our third year. And together, I once again want to thank our two Baalei Achsanya, first of my friends, for once again inviting me, as well as the Aguda once again for hosting me. In the Parsha of Ekev, one of the well-known halachos in Psukim that is mentioned is actually the pasuk that comes towards the beginning here in the Parsha and a little bit into Parakhes, when the Torah tells us, V'yachalta v'savata uveirachta es Hashem alokecha ala aretz hatova asher nasan lach. That when you'll eat, you'll be satiated, you'll therefore bless Hashem on this land, this wonderful land, this Eretz HaTovah, that He has given to you, given to us. Of course, this pasuk is the source, the Chi of the Araisa, for benching. But rather than discuss the laws of benching, I'd like to take a slight liberty and discuss companion brachos. But as you'll see, I think, even though it's an admitted liberty, it's not a huge leap. The Mishnah in the beginning of the sixth parak of Maseches Brachos tells us, very famous Mishnah, Ketzed Mevarchan Al HaPeros, and then goes through to list different types of peros, Yayin, Peros Aretz, Pas, and of course the subject of this Mishnah and this parak is Birchas Hananim, not the benching we say after we've eaten, V'yachalta V'savata, after we're satiated, rather the Birchas Hananim, the brachos that we say on food before we have benefited from them. So first of all, it's worth noting that even though Tosfos here on Daf Lamed Hey and many others seems to be a mashmas in the Gemara on Daf Chaf Aleph assume, and we generally assume halacha, that the brachos before eating the Berachas Hananim are only obligated mida rabbanan. We'll see what the source of that obligation is in a moment. However, it is worth noting, if you just go home with one thing, at least you should go home with the following, and that is that there is a famous Pnei Yoshua. The Pnei Yoshua on this Gemara suggests that, in fact, Birchas Hananim are D'oraisa. Not from the pasuk of Yachalta V'Savata V'Rachta, that's clearly talking about after you've eaten your Saveya. So where is the source for this concept? So Pnei Yoshua is actually based on the continuation of this Gemara, because the Mishnah assumes, as a davar pashut, that there is an obligation to make a bracha before you eat. The Gemara just wants to know, what is the bracha? Ketan mevarchan, which bracha do you make? Before fruit, before vegetables, before bread, before a drink. But the Gemara just assumed, the Mishnah just assumed it. So the Gemara, as it so often does when you have Mishnayos such as this, the Gemara says, hold on. Where do we know from this? Where do you get such an assumption? Nahani Mili. So it's a very fascinating Gemara here on Daf Lamed Hei. And the basic structure of it, there's a lot of digressions in a very typical Gemara fashion. But the basic structure of it is very simple. The Gemara starts off by trying to bring a pasuk. Not the pasuk in our parsha. That would really be easy. But rather, a pasuk about Netzer Ravai. The pasuk tells us that after the 3 years where you're not allowed to benefit from the fruit of the tree, in the fourth year, you'll bring that fruit to Yerushalayim akin to Maaser Sheni, which is a certain years of the seven-year cycle where you bring all you have to bring your produce, the new produce of that year, to Yerushalayim. So the pasuk about Netzer Ravai says, Kodesh Shilulim LaHashem. You'll give praises, Shilulim in plural, to God, to Hashem, Malamish Tu'unim Bracha Lefenehem, Ula Acharehem. So the Gemara here understands that this pasuk equates the obligation to make a bracha before you eat with making a bracha benching after you eat. Now, if this would be accepted, so presumably not only would the Birchas Hananim be the Araisa, but then you'd have a real marriage between the Birchas Hananim before you eat and the benching after you eat. The Gemara here seems to say that it's one unified source, not the Yachalta V'Savata. However, the rest of the Gemara is essentially, and we will not get into the details, it's a windy, digressive type path, but the upshot of the Gemara is that it keeps on questioning and re-questioning and re-questioning, but the upshot of all the questions is, this is not a good source. Each, for different various reasons, you can't bring a proof from this source. Yes, the pasuk does say you have to make a bracha when you're going to bring this netar avai, but that is unique for X, Y, and Z reasons, the Gemara keeps on suggesting. It cannot be a standard source. So after the whole digression, the Gemara, before it gets to the famous statements, which some of you are probably waiting for me to cite, before it gets to those, the Gemara says something which is not as well known. The Gemara suggests the Kal V'Chomer, a very compelling svara. What's the Kal V'Chomer? Kishu hu sova mevarech. Kishu ra'ev lo kol shekein. If I have to thank Hashem after I'm ready, you can sit back, fully satiated. And there I thank Hashem. So shouldn't I all the more so be obligated to thank Him in anticipation of satiating myself when I'm hungry and I'm so in need of it? It's simply then where I should say thank you, shouldn't I? Says the Gemara. That's the rationale. However, the Gemara does seem to leave that, and we'll get to the comments that the Gemara makes subsequently. But it's based on this Kal V'Chomer, if I'm not mistaken, it's particularly this Kal V'Chomer that the Pnei Yeshua suggests. It's a very compelling rationale. The Pnei Yeshua famously suggests that the Birchas Hananim therefore are D'Oraisa. Now, as I said, the Rishonim, for example, the Tosfos here on our Gemara, says, hold on one second. Lav Kal V'Chomer. Even though the Gemara presented as a Kal V'Chomer, but a Kal V'Chomer has the power to do what? To create a Torah obligation, which is where the Pnei Yeshua came from. But the Tosfos right here says, it's not exactly an ironclad Kal V'Chomer. And it's fascinating, not because the Tosfos does not go into puncturing holes why maybe it's not as compelling intellectually, conceptually. Tosfos just as simply, it's Im Kein, Hey Bracha, the Lafan of Mita Araisa. Now the Peshu would say, in our jargon, in Hachinami, exactly. But you see, it's very powerful. The Tosfos just assumes, of course it's only Darabanan, and therefore this can't be a strong Kal V'Chomer. The Gemara didn't mean it that way. It just meant it was almost like a Svara Ba'alma. It's interesting, and we'll get to another Svara or two in a second, which is really what the Gemara is most famous for, not this, but what comes next. But it is worth noting, I don't want to get onto this topic, but for those who are interested, I have Makoros for you. It is interesting that there are places in Chazal, in Gemaras, where we seem to equate the concept of Svara, a rationale, a compelling rationale, and a Torah source, and a Kra. The Gemara will sometimes say, Kra Lomali, Svarahu. What do you need a Torah source, a scriptural source? A Svara is enough, it's a rational thing. And in those Gemaras, it seems like the concept of Svara, compelling logic, is enough to create a Torah obligation. And yet here we've already seen one Svara, the Kal V'Chomer, and we'll see another one in a moment, in which other than this Pnei Yeshua, it seems that it's universally assumed the Birchas Hananim are only Darabanan. So why is it that sometimes the Gemara assumes that our Svaras, which have the power of Daraisa, and other times it's only Rabbinic? That's an interesting question. I haven't seen too many people discuss that in kind of a meta-halachic way, but I have seen some. So those who are interested, that's not our topic tonight, but there are sources on that. As I said, this Tosfos clearly assumed against the Pnei Yeshua. In the Achronim, the most well-known Bar Plukta of Pnei Yeshua was the Tzlach. The Tzlach is the commentary on the Gemara written by who? The note of Yehuda. And the Tzlach is an acronym for Tzil Nefesh Chaya. And that is the sefer that the note of Yehuda wrote on selected Masechtos of Shas. And he goes to town on this Pnei Yeshua, can't be, never meant, never said, it's just impossible. So, there are many other Makoros, Rishonim that imply this, Gemara Da Chafalot that implies the Rabbanon, but if you're looking for a succinct, so to speak, thumbnail, it's a Tzlach in the Pnei Yeshua right here on the Gemara in Brachos and Daf Lamedeh. Now, as the Gemara continues its discussion, we're getting at to the bottom of the Amud, so the Gemara invokes some of its most famous citations, specifically the statements about Brachos. After the whole conclusion, back and forth, this is not a good proof from Netzer Avai, it's not a good proof, it's not a good proof. So what are we left with, says the Gemara in conclusion, Ela Svarahu, Asalo La'adam Shehenem in Olam Azeh, below Bracha. It's just common sense, or we might say common courtesy. You can't benefit from the world, you don't take something from someone, basically without asking please. That would be a colloquial translation of this Gemara. You can't have benefit from this world without making a bracha, which is another way of saying it's not right, it's not courteous. You don't benefit from something that's first out asking please. Once the Gemara concludes, if you want so to speak, the dramatic symptom of this. It's the two dots right there. That's two dots. End of the Gemara. That seems to be the Gemara's conclusion. Why do we know you have to make a bracha? The whole the premise which underlines this whole parak, which underlies this opening Mishnah, is this svara. Asur lo la'adam lehenes me'olam below bracha. However, just to fill in for the flavor of it, so to speak, once the Gemara says that, even though the point is made, there are two dots, the Gemara then does continue, and mention a number of other statements by Chazal, which elaborate on or buttress this point, and while they probably don't add anything halachic, but just to give you a sense of the power, the oomph, of this rationale, I'll just mention them, two of them to you. One is that the Gemara says, right below this, the next thing, Kol anena min ha'olam hazeh v'lo bracha ma'al. It's a violation of Me'ilah. Me'ilah means, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, if the Beis HaMikdash had property, or a particular object was consecrated for the use of the Beis HaMikdash, and instead of using it for its hallowed and sacred purpose, you use it for some personal purpose. Not necessarily degrading, but personal purpose. So that is a violation of Me'ilah. Now what exactly is the nature of the violation of Me'ilah? It's itself a classical question. Many discuss it. There's a famous Reb Chaim Brisker on it. And it's a big question whether it's a strictly kachim halacha, or is Me'ilah a kachim version of pure, unadulterated, common theft? Is Me'ilah gzela, or is it perhaps something slightly different? Again, if we were learning Maseches Me'ilah, or perhaps in Maseches Kiddushin, or other places where they discuss in the context of Eish Lef L'Vayr Avera Me'ilah, so that would be a time to discuss it, not now. But it is certainly a powerful example, an image to reference. The Gemara says it's as if you were doing Me'ilah. Now, Me'ilah is something that's in the property of the Beis HaMikdash. This is my apple. It's not in the property of the Beis HaMikdash. This is my apple. I bought it. Not even my wife. I went to the store. I bought the apple. And yet, the Gemara says, until you've made a bracha, on some level, it's still Hashem's benefit. And if you take it without making a bracha, it's as if you have been ma'al. Which for the sake of our shir, I'll define as, it's as if you've stolen from Hashem. The reason I use that is because in the next, we'll skip another one of the references the Gemara makes, but in the immediate next Amud, you turn the page, Daf Lamed Hey Amud Beis, so there the Gemara says, again the name of a different, of the Chazal, but the Gemara says, a similar but slightly different formulation, Ka'anene min olam hazeh lo bracha, ki'ilu gozeh l'hakadosh baruch hu, the Knesset Yisrael. So here the Gemara explicitly uses the term as if you stole from Hashem. So unless there's something subtle and profound about the earlier reference of Me'ilah, presumably they're basically trying to get at the same point, which is really the same point as we saw at the end right before the two dots, namely, Svarahu Osto La'odam Shehenem Min Olam B'lo Bracha. It's not the right thing to do. You don't take from somebody else unless you've said please. And the profound philosophical point which underlies this technical halakhic discussion is that, to use my illustration, it doesn't matter how much you paid and how much effort you put in to buy the apple, to grow the apple, to whatever the case may be, on some level, Hashem owns everything. Right? As a certain famous media personality says, on loan from God. We'll fill in. Now everything, not just his talent, everything that we all have is on loan from God until we say a bracha, and that's what gives us permission. Now I want to just mention one basic point, which seems to be a machlokes Rashi and the Marsha, just a basic point which elicits, a fundamental machlokes about this concept. And then I want to leave that and for the rest of the time focus on one very specific rule which governs this entire enterprise known as Brachos Hanenin, the Brachos Forim. The fundamental overarching question which seems to exist, it seems to be machlok between Rashi and the Maharsha, about the following very, very basic definition. Tosfos and Daf Yud Beis Amud Aleph and Masechta Brachos is discussing a case. I don't want to get into the details of various permutations, but basically the Gemara is discussing if you thought you had wine and really you had beer, but because you thought you had wine, you started off the words Baruch Hashem thinking you were going to finish Puer Per Gafen, and then you look down and you realize, oh, it's beer. That's Shehakol, that's not Hagafen. And you finished with what was the right bracha, but it wasn't what you intended. Or vice versa, it's inverted, back and forth. So within the context of that discussion, without getting bog down in those details, but in that context, so Tosfos quotes a shita of the Rif. The Rif says that once you've made a bracha, perhaps you might have thought you should make the second bracha also. The big discussion, if I made the bar shahakol and I really should have made a hagafen or vice versa. So the Gemara didn't seem to say this, but Tosfos says, maybe you should say both. Maybe you should say both. So Tosfos first says that the Rif, the famous Rif, Balfasi, he says, true, maybe, but we have a principle. The principle is known as Safek Brachos Lahakel. Whenever we have a doubt in the world of brachos, we err on the side of caution, we don't do it. In other areas, we err on the side of maximal coverage, Safek Lachumra. But brachos, we say Lahakel, we just stay where we are. So says the Rif, once he's away with one bracha, it may be right, and we'll assume it is because we're not going to say a second bracha, Safek Brachos Lahakel. However, and that's, I think, the intuitive shita. However, Tosfos then quotes the Re Balatosfos. The Re says, in fact, you go back and make the second bracha. Again, without getting into details of the cases, nothing that I'm saying about this or anything else tonight should be taken as halakha l'maisa, the final word, practically. But in certain cases, at least, the Re is quoted by Tosfos as saying, enechanami, on the same one drink, you should say two brachos. And that's hard to understand. So Rabbi Kiva Eger in the Gilyan Ashas quotes a Marsha in Masechta the Psachim, Tav Kuf Beis, another good location for these types of halachos. And the Marsha says the following yisod, the following concept, which is directly relevant to our topic. It says, when we talk about brachos, we have to know what kind of brachos we're talking about. A bracha before a mitzvah, a bracha of praise of Hashem, those are not identical, but for our purposes they're the same thing. However, the bracha before you eat, that's not just a praise of Hashem in some general sense. That's based on our principle. It's theft if you don't do it. It's not a mitzvah, it's an iser, or you call it a matir. You're not allowed to eat. It's not just that it's a nice thing, make a mitzvah, say a bracha before you light Shabbos candles. You're prohibited from eating the apple or the peach or, let's think big, the delicious steak. You're prohibited until you've done it. Asr lehanus, b'olam hazeh, b'lo bracha. So says the Marsha, you don't say the rule of Safek Brachos Lahakel when it comes to Birchas Hananim. That's only true when you have a bracha that's a mitzvah. But a bracha which is a matir, which is basically taking you out of an iser, a prohibition, how can you err on the side of caution and say, well, I may be stealing, I may not be, I'll just assume I'm not. Something like theft, Zela, Safek Lachumra. We don't say the rule of Safek Brachos Lahakel, says the Marsha, you sowed on Birchas Hanen. What do you see from this discussion? You see, at least in potential, two different conceptions of Birchas Hanen, our topic for tonight. And Marsha, we'll start with the second one. The Marsha seems to say what is the simple, more direct understanding of our Gemara. That the concept of making a bracha before you eat something is, in our halakhic terminology, a matir. It allows you to do something you otherwise would not be allowed to do. However, apparently there's another notion, perhaps what the Re holds. And that is that even though our Gemara couches it in the rationale of avoiding theft, perhaps that's more of a dramatic, almost if you will, poetic license. It's an underlying rationale, perhaps. But is it really theft? Come on, of course not. And especially if you go back to the original source in the Gemara, Kodesh Hilulim, you have a different concept in mind. It's an anticipation. It's a thanks in anticipation. You know, sometimes when you open up the present that your parents or children get you, so after you open the present, oh, I love it, thank you so much. But sometimes, even before you know what it is, even before you benefited from it, just the fact that you know you're going to get something in anticipation, you can already be appreciative and thank the person. So, from the beginning of the Gemara, and it may be that the Re understood that this is still true l'maskana, ultimately, Birchas Hananin aren't a matir, they're a mitzvah. Perhaps only a mitzvah mirabanon, maybe benching is a mitzvah daraisa. Birchas Hananin are a mitzvah mirabanon, but they're only a mitzvah. Now, I want to just point out to you that there's two Rashis, which I have to admit I've seen many times before, and I never picked up on this till preparing for tonight's shiur. There's two Rashis that are very relevant right on the daf, it's important to know, and another Marsha on our daf, which clearly makes it clear what we're trying to suggest in the Marsha and Sochim, he's very clear on brachos. the two different places in our Gemara in which it mentions this rationale of Asur L'Adam Lehanos, or anyone who is benefit is as if he stole from God, on both of those Gemaras, Rashi says the following. On the first statement, Rashi says, it's a svara that you have to make a bracha. Why? The kevah denana tarach lahodos l'mi shabar am. The svara isn't that if you didn't make a bracha, you were stealing. The svara Rashi says, even though that's what the Gemara he's commenting on, but Rashi, so to speak, forces onto the language of the Gemara a slightly different conception. Rashi says it's a compelling logic that you have to make a bracha because you should be hodos, you should thank the one who created the source of your benefit. And even more to the point, and more dramatically, on the Gemara that refers to the person who eats without making a bracha as a gazlan, you stole, you're a thief. So what did you steal, pray tell? What did you steal? Says Rashi, two words, et berchaso. You stole Hashem's bracha. You didn't steal the fruit. What are you kidding? You bought the fruit. It's your fruit. You didn't steal the fruit. It's a euphemism. But what did Hashem not get that he should have? A bracha. You're not really a thief. It means that there's a mitzvah to make a bracha. And if you didn't do the mitzvah, in a sense, and here I would say in English it works well, in quotes, you robbed Hashem of his mitzvah. Does that make you a thief? In any sense of the word, no. You robbed Hashem of his bracha, because it's a mitzvah. This is, Mamash, these Rashi's work, I think, very beautifully with the Re. However, the Marsha on this Gemara, and there's a Ritzvah who says it's befeirish, the Marsha says, I think the way most of us have always presumed, when we knew this Gemara, Aslo L'Adam Lehenos, it's Ma'al, it's Gazlan. So Marsha says, however you understand this is not a class in theology tonight, but however you understand this, the Marsha says, the Ritzvah says explicitly also, but for our purposes, the Marsha is more important. You stole the benefit. God is the owner of that benefit, whether you call it the tangible peach or steak, or the intangible shock. Whatever it is, God owns it. And if you don't make a bracha, you stole that. It's not like Rashi said you stole the bracha. You stole the benefit. The benefit was illicit. So that is the Marsha v'shitaso from Sachem. In both cases, the Marsha says, what's a bracha? A bracha is a matir. You're not allowed to benefit, and it's as if you're stealing it. It was usur, it'll be mutter if you make the bracha. Whereas the Re may have disagreed, and I think Rashi, it's clear. Again, in general, whenever you see a Rishon explaining something, whether independently it's compelling, but the very fact that it's different and almost forced in the Lashon of a Gemara is always something that should be, you know, bright lights should go off in your head. Something, you know, why would Rashi go out of his way not to say, like the Marsha? The Marsha is the simple understanding of the Gemara. So I think it's clear to me, from the language, as well as the fact that it's so different than the simple understanding of the Gemara, Rashi's going out of his way to say, you're not stealing, it's not a matir. There's a mitzvah to make a bracha, and you're not doing what you're supposed to do. You didn't do the mitzvah you were supposed to. Are there ramifications of this machlokas? Maybe. Maybe the Tosfos with the Suffolk Brachos L'Hakel. Maybe others. But this is a very fundamental, fundamental question in understanding the whole notion of Birchas Hananim. Are they a mitzvah or are they a matzir? So I want to just kind of stop part A of the shir now and use our remaining time to discuss a very, very interesting, really a fascinating Gemara and a halacha really in a Gemara, which comes later in the Perek, which in a sense is a very specific detail in this general chapter of Brachos, but I think it's one that's very, very fascinating and perhaps very, very telling. The Mishnah here, later in the Perek, on that Mem Dalid Amad Aleph, talks about the following case. Heviyu lefanav maliach tchila. The first dish, the first thing you're about to eat, is some salty food. Says the Mishnah continuation. Upas imo. And they also brought some bread with the salty food, says the Mishnah, Mevarech al hamaliach, you make a bracha on the salty food, it's a shahakol, it's a bracha, whatever the food is that's salty, you make a bracha on that, and, good, thank you, upoter sapas, you don't have to make a bracha on the bread. You don't have to make a bracha on the bread. Why? So the Mishnah continues, the haklal, kol shu ikur, the imo tfela, if you have two things, but one is primary, and the other is secondary. In this case, Mefarshim explained, because you're only eating the bread
to cut down on the potency of the salted food. It's too salty to eat on your own. So you cut the taste a little bit. You know, we sometimes do that with crackers, or in this case it was with bread. So since it's really only serving the purpose of the other food, that's the finest primary ikker. You make a bracha on the ikker, says the Mishnah. You don't make a bracha on the secondary, on the tuffel. That is the specific case of the Mishnah. And the Mishnah, as it does not usually do, the Gemara Mishnah doesn't just list the case, it elicits a common principle from that case. Now one more point before we get into really analyzing the details of this principle. The Gemara wants to know, what kind of food are we talking about? I mean, usually bread is the staple. The Gemara asks, "Mi ikar midi d'hav maliach ikar pachmela?" What dish is it in which you have a bread-based dish or a bread composite in the dish, and yet you still don't consider the bread the ikar? Usually, if the bread's involved, that's going to be the ikar. Thank you. You've heard me give enough shirim to know when my voice is giving out. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Call me a bivaro. That would be a berachas hanen. Mitzvah, I'm out here. Okay. Thank you. So the Gemara says, what's the case? Amar Rav Abira, Abira, Amar Rav Ashi, Ba'ochle Peros Genosar. Special fruits that came from Genosar. If I'm not mistaken, I think Rashi, the other Mepharshim say Genosar is really where? The Kinneret, exactly. And why was it called? Really, the name is Genosar. And Kinneret comes because it hints at the sweetness of the foods that were famous from this area of Eretz Yisrael. But says the Gemara, these sweet fruits were so, so sweet, and therefore, so this is actually the therefore, just so we should understand the case, I always understood the Gemara like Rabbeinu Yonah. But then, I'm embarrassed to say, I never paid attention to the fact that Tosfos clearly has a different understanding of the case. What Rabbeinu Yonah seems to say, which I don't know, it's just that I always understood it that way, it doesn't mean Rabbeinu Yonah is more likely right or not, but what Rabbeinu Yonah says explicitly is that the case is where the Gemara is basically redefining the Mishnah. The case of Miluach is, Maliach, excuse me, is Peres Genosar. The fruits are what the Mishnah referred to as salty. Why does the Mishnah refer to them as salty if really the Gemara said they're so super duper duper sweet? Abnormally sweet? So either because Maliach doesn't just literally mean spicy or salty, it means an extreme taste. Or as Rabbeinu Yonah seems to say, because they're so sweet that the way they used to eat them was they used to put some salt on them, and somehow, don't ask me for the science behind it, that made the sweetness actually enjoyable as opposed to naturally the sweetness was too much. Now I know that some people like to put a little bit of salt on fruit because it brings out the taste and they make it sweeter. So I don't know maybe if you reach a point of no return, where it's so sweet, so the salt brings it down a little bit, or maybe there's a certain type of salt, I'm not sure. But that's what Rabbeinu Yonah says. That's what Rabbeinu Yonah says, that the Gemara was basically substituting Peres Genosar for Maliach. Tosfos, as we'll see, Tosfos assumes actually that it's a three-course meal. Why only have two courses? It could have three. I agree with for sure. Why not? So it says the fun. What really I had? The fruit. That was the first dish. That was so sweet, my mouth was, I don't know what the metaphor is, on fire, or when something is so, so sweet that you can't handle it. Then, as a antidote to how sweet it is, you took something that was very salty, right? Different part of the tongue. Then you're on fire from the salty, and then you had the bread. And Tosfos understand that you made one bracha, because what was the ikar? The ikar was the fruit. You only ate the salt because of the fruit, you only ate the bread because of the salt. So you made a bracha on the fruit, the Peres Genosar, and that took care of the maliach and the bread. Now Tosfos asks, Tosfos assumes that you made two brachas. After all, the Mishnah said you made a bracha on maliach, The Mishnah said you made a bracha on maliach. So Tosfos assumes first you made a bracha on the sweet, then you go, ooh, I need the salty, but the salty takes care of the bread. So Tosfos asks why what I mistakenly said wasn't true. Right? Logically, in the thrust of the Mishnah, the ikar was the fruit. And yet Tosfos assumes that he made a bracha both fruit and salt. So Tosfos gives two answers. The first answer is, Demarish lo'ochla peres osam maimid. It was completely different times. Right? Maybe a different chorus. One was the shmor, one was the main. Different times. But the Gemara says, Inam, but Tosfos Inam, Yibushash Ochla Peres Kinosar, Lo Hayush Shamadayim Aliyah.
upas. Lohaya yodeya shiachlashivo machmas hamatikos.
It was all one sitting, one course. But originally, you were just going to have the fruit. Then when you went to the waiter, you know, sweet, sweet. So then he said, oh, here's the, oh, yeah, in our part of the town, whenever you get the food too sweet, here's salt and bread. So either for one of those reasons, either it was a completely different sitting, or you just never intended, and therefore they weren't even on the table at the time. Either way, says Tosfos, he assumes you made first a bracha on the sweet, then on the salt, but the point being still, no bracha on the bread. And what's the principle that's being enunciated by our Gemara, as was originally mentioned, the concept of ikar and tafel in brachos. That when you have a composite, either of one dish that has multiple things of different brachos, or you have, in this case, two foods eaten one after the other, but it's all one serving the purpose of the other, because of the continuation, if you could define one as the ikar, then a bracha on that is what you make, and you don't make a bracha on the tafel. Now there are millions, or I shouldn't say millions, myriads of permutations of this, and that's why if you open up Shulchan Aruch, or for that matter if you buy a contemporary Sefer Nachos Brachos, you invariably have a whole chapter with 150 footnotes called Ikar V'Tafel, because there's myriads, you know, what's the Ikar, right? The ice cream or the cone, and the chocolate or the peanut butter, and what if you have a cereal with the nuts and the flakes, and of course the ultimate, what's the most difficult? No, that's not so difficult. I mean, it's first of all, delicious. So anything bad about cholent is already just a little bit of an aver to say. But no, what's the most difficult of the brachas question? Perhaps today, I'll give you a hint. It has to do with breakfast? Who said Crispix? Raise your hand. Be proud. Crispix! I know a Shor Shiva who will not eat Crispix. Because he cannot figure out what to do. The only thing I once asked him, because my kids like Crispix, said you have to break it. Break, you have to, now, who wants to separate it? Not me, I just buy Fruit Loops. But Crispix is a very difficult shiloh, right? We all know what it is, right? What is it? The corn and? Oh, there you go. What's ikra? What's tafel? So we're not getting into any of those technical details that are important, but that's not our topic. What I want to discuss with you is something more lomdish, something more conceptual. How do we understand this concept of ikra and tafel? Right? Leave aside the fruit for a moment. I have salt, salty food, and I got my bread. I got my herring and my tam-tam. Ikar and tafel, it's a Mishnah. Mishnah before Reshes. We pass this way in Shulchan Aruch. How do you understand this? Why should it be? There's no pasuk here. Na'vechal tevezavata, na'kar shilulim. What's the rationale? What's the svar? What's the concept?
Subjective.
That's how you, that, you're getting to a different question, is how do you define ikar? Which we'll see is a question, perhaps even in the Gemara. But I'm saying, however you define the ikar, right?
What do you want to eat?
No, but why is that enough? Why not make two brachos? Why should one bracha count? That's my question. Let's get to the heart of the issue. Only if you're not obligated. But why aren't you obligated? Or what? So let me kind of bring out, tease out this question with a suffix of the Prima Gadim. The Prima Gadim has the following question. Let's say, and again, just so I don't want to get trapped in any practical halacha shaylos that people are going to leave tonight, quoting Rabbi Gottlieb said on this and that, I'm not passing on Crispix, I'm not passing on ice cream cones, and I'm not passing on cholent, just eat the cholent. Make a motzi and eat the cholent. That's easy. So, let's stick with the Mishnah. You got my salty food and I have my bread. Ask the Prima Gadim a question. So, theory, I should just make the bracha on the ikar. Fine. Let's say when I'm making the bracha on the salty food and the maliach, and don't ask me why I would do such a thing, but I did. I had express intent. I was mechaven that bracha should not help me for the pas, should not help me for the bread. That's the Prima Gadim question. Does it help or not? Does it still help? After all, the Mishnah says, Zahakwal. Once you make a bracha on the ikar, a bracha on the tafel. Or do you say, if I had in mind, I don't want it to count, so I can, so to speak, overpower the halacha, and it won't count. The Prima Gadim does not resolve this question. He's so torn by this question, he leaves it betzarachian. So I think the proper way to understand this suffix is, again, it really teases out the two possible understandings of this Mishnah and this Halacha. One possible understanding of the Mishnah is when we say Ikar and Tafel, what that means is, if I have two foods, one is I'm only eating it to cut down on the sharpness or the saltiness of the other one. What's my prime benefit? What am I really trying to eat? The ikker. And in such case, b'chihai gavna, there is no obligation on the tofa. Because it's just to use other concepts of halacha. Sometimes we say, don't worry about this, it's the batel to the other thing. It's tofel to the other thing. It loses its independent identity. So perhaps with ikker and tofel, it's the same thing. When all the bread is there is to cut down the sharpness of the maliach, so perhaps it has no independent identity. You're never not obligated. We ask, why not make the brachas? Because I'm not obligated to make the brachas. I'm only obligated to make the bracha on the ikker. If you'll tell me that they're both ikker, I'm not sure which one's ikker. Okay, so then maybe, and we'll have to see in such a case maybe, but for now I'll say maybe. You make two brachas. But when you can, if you can clearly define one as the ikker, the other one is, to borrow the term, batel to the first. That's one possibility. However, there's a second possibility. Anyone want to take a stab at it? Make me proud. Who wants to take a stab at it? What's the other possible understanding? One understanding is that there's no obligation on the tofel.
It's not even a kilo. It's a lubricant effect.
I think if that's no, but I think if you're right, that would be with the first thing I said. And therefore, I would say, that's what you just said, and therefore, I'm not even obligated to make a bracha. I want a whole different conception. Doctor. Very good, Dr. Leader. The bracha on the first food, on the ikker, counts for the tofel. I did make a bracha on the tofel. It's the bracha that I made on the ikker. Right? Who said you can't get anything for free in this world? You get two foods for the price of one. So it's the original, ultimate two for one. I'll make a bracha on the ikker, and that is chal, that counts on the tofel. L'chora, it is that suffek, that shiloh, which is at the heart of the Prima Gadim suffek. Prima Gadim said, you had in mind not to be yotzei the tofel. What's the halacha? So it depends. According to the first sad, the one that Dr. Graydon was fleshing out, so it's as if it doesn't exist, it's just a lubricant, it's just tofel to the first. There is no obligation. So what's the difference that I had a kavanah that the bracha shouldn't go on it? There's no obligation to be a bracha to begin with. And according to that conception, you need the second thing, yotzei the tofel is only yoni for a bracha. But if you hold, like what Rafal Leader said, that really, 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 there is an obligation on the tofel. It's just that the chiddush of the mission is that the bracha of the ikker can count for the tofel. But maybe that doesn't work if I become one of them wanted to. We have that, again, without getting too far afield, we have that in other areas where I have kavana to be mosi someone, my subjective intent helps. And if I have kavana not to be mosi someone, my subjective intention helps. Again, so to hear, if I have an obligation to make a bracha on the tafel, that's only if I want my one bracha to count for two. The two for one does work, if I want it to. But if I don't want it to, I expressly had kavana not to, then it doesn't work. If it doesn't work because I had kavana not to, then of course, taka, I would make a bracha on the tafel. Let me give you a few other nafkaminas, which I think will further flesh out these two understandings of the pot, of this halacha we're talking about, of ikker and tafel. Shulchan Aruch in Siman Reish Ches Siv Tezayin quotes a halacha, which we know also from Brachos, that when it comes to beverages, wine, yayin, is an ikar. And if in one meal you've already made a birchas hayayin, again, without getting into details, but this is what it says in Shulchan Aruch, the yayin, the bracha of the yayin, the wine, will be take care of the brachos that you would need for any other things. So take a simple example, wine and water. Let's for a moment consider the fact that you do make a bracha, achrona, on other foods, not just benching on bread. Right? That's known as the alamichya or the bari nefashos. It depends on what you ate. So what is the bracha achrona on wine? Alagafen or alamichya, right? What is the bracha achrona on water? Now, unlike the first bracha before you eat, in which even if you just take a little bit, you have to make a bracha, when it comes to brachas after you've eaten, we know, without getting into the details, there are all sorts of minimum requirements, all sorts of shiurim. That's only if I ate a certain amount before I eat, of course I make a bracha. But do I have to make a bracha afterwards? Well, it depends. How much did I eat? As I get the picture books, and this book, some of the contemporary books, what's the shiur for this, what's the shiur for that, how many cookies equals a kazayas, and all that kind of thing, right? So let me ask you the following question. Let's say I had wine. It's a dinner shulchan aruch. The wine is the ikker, the water is the tofel. But let's say I did not have a revius. I did not have the shear of yayin.
But I did have the shear, so
I don't have to make, if I was just drinking a little wine, no
oligarchy.
But I had water right afterwards. I didn't need to make a shahako on the water, because it's tough to my yayin. But I did have a shear of mine. Do I have to make a brayin of pashas or not? Yes. Anyone want to say no? Anyone want to say no? Okay, there you go. You should just know, anyone who's been with me for sure, I never do that if there's a potential of someone being embarrassed. When I do that, it means that you're both going to be right. Okay, so Claude Gottlieb, you remember this, I'm going to invite you back next year. You have nothing to lose when I ask a question like that. He did. That's not the case. My share, I get to pick the case. A little prerogative, you have to allow me. Even if I'm a guest, but I already said Rosh Hashanah to my hosts. Not a shear of yayin, but I did have a shear of water. Again, depends on our chakira. If you assume, like the first tzaddik, we're now calling that the Graydon's approach, that there's no chiyuv on the tafel. So just like there's no chiyuv of a bracha rishon on the tafel, presumably there's also no bracha achrona on the tafel. Because it's nothing, it's just part of the ikur. But if you assume that really, really there's a chiyuv, it's just that whatever I'll say on the ikur counts for the tafel. So when it comes to the bracha rishona, the barak ragofen helps me for the bracha rishona. But if, in this particular case, which I made up, you don't make a bracha achrona on the yayin, so you're still chayiv to make a bracha achrona on the water, just like you really were chayiv to make a bracha rishona on it. You just didn't, because the bracha on the yayin counts for the bracha on the water. Let me give you another one. This gets to... I can't hear you.
Why doesn't the shear for the water answer the shear of the yayin?
I don't see you. If I don't see you, I can't answer you. Not that I don't want to, I can't communicate like this. I'm sorry. But the case is two separate things. It's two separate things. So take a look. It's in Simon Reish Ches, Sif Tez Zayin. I'm not hiding it from you. Let me tell you another case. This was mentioned before. A few different people were discussing, and I alluded to with the ice cream and this. How do you define which one is the Iker and which one is Tafel? So sometimes, perhaps, you may have one which is the dominant food, let's say in quantity, for example, but it's the other one which is Chavav, the other one which you really want. The Gemara is talking about a dish which was beets and olive oil. That's just a particular case. And the Gemara says it depends, right? Which one is chaviv, which one is ikr. So, depends on the case. The case of the Gemara is, the Gemara talks about this, and the Gemara says one thing about which one, but then the Beis Yosef quotes that you would only make a bracha on the beets, which are really a secondary food to olives, of course, but if they're both ikr and chaviv. But if you really love the olive oil, that's your chaviv, but the dominant quantity of the dish is beets, so the Beis Yosef says, then you would make two brachos. First on the chaviv, first on the oil, and then on the beets. So Frank the Taz and the Magen Avram, what about the concept of bracha she'ena tzricha? We don't look to make brachos when we don't have to. And really, the din in the Gemara, when you have this beet oil dish, was one bracha. Yeah, they're coming up with a case where you'd have to make two. So it happens to me that the Taz and the Magen Avraham give technical answers. But I saw a very nice aura from a sefer called the Mishnas Yosef. Mishnas Yosef is written by a contemporary Talmud Chacham. He should live and be well. He's already had Arichas Yamim. His name is Rav Yosef Lieberman. He's one of the Chachmei Yerushalayim. And, sorry? I have in other contexts referred to him as the real Joe Lieberman. Yes. I like him very much. I've met him once or twice. For those who, next time you're in Yerushalayim, if you go into the community, if you know where the Sadi Ger Beis Medrash, not to confuse with Ger, which is much bigger, Sadi Ger, which is the Hasidus of the Rebbe who lives in Tel Aviv, but the Sadi Ger Beis Medrash in Geula, and the Rav of that Beis Knesset, he has also Yeshiva, he's very well known Talmud Chacham, but he's the Rav. If you go there for Shabbos, Amos Shabbosos, as I did twice to see him, you will meet him there, and it'll be a big schos. So he suggests that the concept of bracha she'ena tzricha as a problematic concept is only the case if you assume that I'm chayiv in two things, and one bracha would take care of both. So who gave you a right to start saying two when you could have just said one? So you're potentially vulnerable not what the answer to the question, because the Tazen Magen Avraham gave technical answers. But when there's even a question that gets off the ground, he said, are you even theoretically, potentially vulnerable to the charge of bracha l'mitzvicha? Because that's true if you're obligated, but one bracha would take care of both. So then why not do one? That's meaning you're only vulnerable according to the second side, we'll call that a false side. But if you hold that there's really no chiyuv to begin with, so what am I doing in this case? I'm essentially putting myself in a situation where I am now chayav to make two. Not that I had one that could have taken care of two. I had one that could have taken care of one because I'm only chayav in one. But in such a case, I'm putting myself in a situation where I'm not chayav in two. For example, he gives us an analogy. You know, you're not allowed to make brachos in an environment which is foul smelling and dirty. You're not allowed to make brachos. So let's say you've got to be in prison for an extended period of time and it's a horrible filth and odor. You have to starve because you're not allowed to make a bracha? The answer is no, you're not obligated to make a bracha there, you could eat. So would you say, I shouldn't try to get to a place that's clean? Bracha shein tzricha, I could stay in the foul place and not make a bracha? Of course, that's ludicrous. You don't say that about putting yourself in a place of chiyuv. So he suggests also that when you're vulnerable to this charge, it will also be dependent on the chakira. Let me mention one last thing, which is actually nothing to do with Hilchos Brachos, but I think because of that, it's even more dramatic in illustrating these two conceptions. And then we'll transfer, as I guess, as the minhag, to a little parsha. There was a 19th century Hungarian posek who has tshuvas called Levushe Mordechai. When I was younger, I used to confuse this sefer with the, at least in my circles, the more well-known sefer, Levushe Mordechai, by Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the great Slobodka Rosh Yeshiva, whose children and sons-in-law were the ones who were miyaseid Chevron, first in HaKodesh Chevron, and then after the terrible massacre, brought it to Yerushalayim. But he was the one, if I'm not mistaken, the next generation were four, who were from his mishpacha, his four sons-in-law. I believe that's how it went in the Chevron lineage. So he's Levushe Mordechai too, but this is not him. This is a 19th century Hungarian posek, who has nice tshuvas for him, which in halacha l'maisa world are important. So he has the following question. On Sukkot, you're not allowed to eat bread out of the sukkah. Let's say I'm having this dish in the Mishnah. The maliach, the salty fish or the salty food is my ikker, but the bread is a tefil. Do I have to eat that in the sukkah? Fascinating question, no? Furthermore, he asks, on the first night of Sukkot, on the first night of Pesach, I have a chiyuv to have a kazayis, a bread or matzah. So we know we usually have the lechem Mishnah right away on Sukkot. Or on Pesach, we have the matzah just alone. But let's say, theoretically, a person had a sufficient quantity of kazayis, of matzah, or challah, respectively, but he did it as a tofel to some other food, like a maliach. Is that sufficient to count for a mitzvah achilas matzah? Is that sufficient to count for the mitzvah d'araisa of eating in the sukkah on Sukkot night? Two different questions, basically. So he suggests that this is also going to be dependent on our chakira. If you hold like the first approach that the tefil, again, I like your formulation, it's so nothing, it's not lubricant, it's a nothing for the ikker, so just like it's a nothing for being obligated in a bracha, he suggests it's a nothing to be obligated in sukkah, and it's also a nothing to fulfill the mitzvah of matzah. That's what he says. However, unfortunately without the grading, the Levushe Mordechai passes like a fall leader. Are you Hungarian or fall? Because I know he's English. That's okay. So the Levushe Mordechai taka holds like the second side. He paskins l'maitza. He's not just clearing in lomdus. He gives a psak. He holds, but it's a conceptual psak. So the psak is that we hold like the second idea, that the bracha on the ikur counts. It's as if magically, invisibly, it's as if you made the bracha on the tafel as well. Because we do view it as being koshet. If I had more time, which I don't, he has four different rayas for that. But we didn't have time for that. But and therefore, because we hold that's the idea of the bracha, since it's going on the second food also, therefore it's a significant enough of achila, you would be obligated, the whole yontif, be obligated to eat such food in the sukkah. And furthermore, on the first night, that would be able to count for your basic kazayas of achilas mitzvah, whether it be on sukkahs or pesach respectively. So even though that is not about brachos directly, just because we pass like you're a follower, I'll get to you in a second. But he says, just like we see it by brachos, so too it has hashlachos. It has applications beyond the narrow question of how do I make a bracha, which to me is not kind of besides the point or external, it really, really brings it home of these two conceptions. Because if it was just a technical question of brachos, you wouldn't necessarily be able to apply it to these other areas of halacha. But if you really see that there's a fundamental conceptual issue underlying the question, is it that there's no obligation, or that there is an obligation, but the one bracha counts? So then, if you're a little daring, and the Levushei Mordechai was, you could even beyond broaden the scope and apply it to other areas like on Sukkot or Beis Yisrael. He's not discussing halacha. I don't think he discussed it, and I didn't think about it. But I hear you. Again, we're not recommending this. Even he wasn't recommending it. But be that as it may. Okay. I didn't hear you. What about it? Oh, you mean how do you do the technicalities? He didn't discuss. I don't know. Maybe he held like a German minhag. I don't know. I didn't think about it. I don't think it would be such a big deal because it's all part of the same achilo. I don't think that would be ethnic. But he didn't discuss it and I didn't think about it. Okay. Let's do a little goddess or chumash here. The pasuk, a very famous pasuk in our parasha, perhaps the most well-known pasuk in Parashas Ekev, tells us at the beginning of Chamishi, Perek Yud, pasuk Yud days, Va'ata Yisrael, Ma Hashem Elokecha Shoel Me'imach. What is it that Hashem wants from you? Ki'im Le'yuras Hashem Elokecha, you should fear Him, La'lechet V'chol Drocha, V'la'avas L'avodes Hashem Elokecha, V'chol Avavcha, V'chol Nafshecha. But it's really that opening salvo of the pasuk, which is the famous, famous citation, Ma Hashem Elokecha Doresh Me'imach Ki'im Le'yiras Hashem Elokecha. What's the main thing Hashem wants from you? Awe or fear. And now, I will not discuss how to translate Yiras Shemayim. That's its own shir in its own right. But Yiras Shemayim, in whatever sense, and for all purposes we'll call it, in all of its applications, Yiras Shemayim, Ma Hashem Elokecha Doresh Me'imach Ki'im. You wonder what the one thing is? You have to. So this pasuk always reminds me of a medrash which mentions this pasuk second. But it's a medrash which is, I think, not only is it really relevant to Akev, but it's particularly relevant because the first thing that it's talking about, we're not that far away in Chodesh Elul. We know in the L'davar Hashem Ori, which we say in Elul, in the month of Elul, through the Shmini Atzeres, we have what's the most famous pasuk there? Acha shalalti me'eis Hashem. There's one thing I want from you, Hashem. Shivti me'eis Hashem, kol yemei chayai, lachlos v'ram Hashem, levake be'echa lo, gifnei v'sukkah, etc. So the Medrash puts these two psukim together in the following way. And listen closely, because it's an incredible Medrash. The Medrash says that Hashem, Yisbarach, went to David HaMelech and said, Achutzpah, say what you mean, and mean what you say. You started off saying, Acha Shoalti, Hashem, I'm only going to ask for one thing. Shivti Beis Hashem, you keep on rattling off things. Yeah. If you're going to ask for one thing, ask for one thing. And if you're not, then be honest about it. Ooh. So if that's not amazing enough, David HaMelech, forgive the expression, but there's no other description of this medrash, stares down the Rabbi Shimon. Doesn't give an inch, says David HaMelech. I learned it from you. After all, in Parshas Ekev, what does the pasuk say? Ata Yisrael Ma Hashem Elokecha Shoel Me'imach Ki'im. Ki'im. Just but one thing. Liras Hashem Elokecha. Lalechet V'chol Drocha. La'avo so. La'avo Nes Hashem Elokecha. And as the Medrash specifically says, and after all, even if there's no more chiyuv in Dvarim, you open up Sefer Yoshua, and we have the most dramatic chiyuv, Yigisu Vayom V'Laila. A lot of things that Hashem wants from us. And it's not just things that He asked in the past. He's going to still ask them. Ad kan the Medrash. Oh, that's a Medrash. What do you make of this Medrash? What do you make of such a Medrash? So I saw a very beautiful explanation from the contemporary Rosh Hashiva, Rav Baruch Mordechai Yisrachi. And he said the following. So the question, or not our question, our difficulty understanding the Medrash is because we are misunderstanding. The Achas, or even the Ki'im, it doesn't mean one. Yes, Achas does mean one. But in the pasuk, David HaMelech did not mean it in the literal sense, one thing, Achas Shalom. What he meant was not one in a quantitative way, but rather, what is the bare minimum? I'm asking Hashem for the bare minimum. That's all. I can live without everything but. What's the bare minimum I need? David HaMelech said, Achas Shalom. Well, what happened when he started saying that? He thought that the bare minimum was Shifti B'Veis Hashem. But once he thought about it, that's it. My whole relationship is going to be just defined to that one context, Shifti B'Veis Hashem. But there's so much more. I can't live without all the other things. To live without Levatir B'Hechalo, to live without Lachos B'Noam Hashem, I can't live without that. I thought the bare minimum was Shifti B'Veis Hashem. But now I realize I can't live without this and this and this. So too in Parshas Eker, Achas to me, Ma Hashem Shoel Neima, Kiim, the bare minimum. Hashem says to the Jewish people, the bare minimum I need from you, the bare minimum relationship that a father needs to have with his children, the bare minimum. So it's an interesting choice. Why is it Yira? But Hashem, the Kaviyachol, thought the bare minimum is I can live with just Yira. But then Hashem says, one second, my relationship with my children is just going to be Yira? Imagine for a moment that I've had this, I have to say, sometimes when I've had to play a role mediating between parents and children. You have some parents who are very machbid on the Yira. And sometimes they're even within their rights. But I've told them, and I'm sure we know people like this in our own circumstances. Is that the kind of relationship you really want to have with the children? You want to have just a Yira relationship? How tragic would it be? Could you imagine after 120? Yes, the child did everything you said because he had Yira for you. And that's it. Is that a relationship? Does any parent say, I'm signing on for that? No, because if it happens, it happens. But does anyone want that? Does anyone ask for that? So Hashem starts off, Kavyochol, saying, Hashem, show me mach. One thing I can, that's all I need, the bare minimum, is Yira. One second, that's it? That's all I'm going to have? I don't just need that. I need Ava, Simcha, not just Yira. It's the flip side to David HaMelech's Achas Shoalti. What's the common thread? That the bare minimum is the maximum. The minimum is everything. Superficially, instinctively, first, we think we can live with a partial relationship with Hashem. In a sense, as David HaMelech says in the Medrash, and I learned it from you, because you said, you thought you could live with a partial relationship with us. But then I realized the mere minimum is everything. To have a partial relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not the bare minimum. It's inconceivable. Once I realize what it is to have a relationship with Hashem, once I realize how profound, how beautiful, inspirational just having Yira is, just having Shimti B'Veis Hashem, I can't just suffice with that. I want the whole thing. I want to be greedy. I want it all. Not because I'm being greedy and I want everything, because the bare minimum is everything. The minimum is the maximum. If we appreciate what it means to have a relationship with Hashem, if we appreciate that these are not just obligations, but beautiful opportunities, a life of mitzvos. So then, can we suffice? We would say, Achas Shoalti, there's only one thing I want, and it's a partial relationship with you? Yes, David HaMelech is teaching us something profound as a child to a parent, and in a very powerful way, fitting like a glove, says the Medrash. Our parsha teaches us the way Hashem looks at his relationship with us. You might have thought, Tanach, maybe a partial relationship is possible. And maybe in human relationships, they're complicated, and the stakes, even in close relationships, are relatively low. But the stakes in a relationship with a Kadosh Baruch Hu, a relationship with Hashem, the bare minimum is everything. The bare minimum is a maximal relationship. If we appreciate the relationship, if we think that there is a minimum that leaves out a little or a lot, so that means that we don't have a proper appreciation of what the relationship is, what a life of Torah Mitzvot is. But just like David HaMelech realized Achas Shoalti is many things, not just one, Kadosh Baruch Hu himself, Kaviyachol, realized Ma'ashem alakas v'sharash mimach is not just ki'im l'yira, but it's everything else in the continuation of the pasuk and everything else in the Torah. Because the minimum, if you appreciate the beauty, the minimum is everything. The minimum, the bare minimum, is everything, is the maximum. Which helps.